Good morning, everyone. My name is Rob Freudenberg. I'm the Vice President for Energy and Environment at Regional Plan Association. Before we get started, I just want to acknowledge Governor Florio in the room with us. Governor, thank you for being here. We have a great panel this morning discussing the issue of expand the region's carbon market. And what we're doing with the sessions this year is that an RPA staff member is providing an overview and some background of the issue before we hear from the panelists that we have here. So, first of all, I just want to thank all of our panelists, Dale, Kate, Jean, and Kate, and our moderator, Rit, who you'll all hear from in just a bit. And as we did in the main ballroom, we're trying some new technology, and we'll see if it works or not. If you would like to submit a question via this Slido, you know, the directions are here, and submit your questions. And if we find that we don't want to do it, we can go to the old-fashioned mic system as well. We might do both. Okay. So we're here today to talk about the fourth plan recommendation, expand the region's carbon market, and we have a great panelist to have this discussion. And I thought I'd start with this chart, which is a very non-RPA-looking chart because it's kind of crude and ugly, but I was so happy to still find it on the NOAA page, on the NOAAClimate.gov page, that I had to include it. But it does take us back to, you know, what are we doing this for? What is happening, you know, outside the issue of a carbon market and adaptation, all things we're talking about, what's actually happening? Our globe is getting hotter and is projected to keep getting hotter. And we know that, thank you, Climate Central, for this slide. We know that from just what we've been experiencing in the past few years. The last 4 years have been the hottest years on record. Last year was the third hottest year. We also know that hurricane seasons are different than they have been. 2017 was both the most active and most expensive hurricane season on record in the U.S. 2018 is looking to be about an average or above average season itself. We also know that the consequences of a warmer planet are having other effects. We are seeing sea level rise happen already, and the projections are that it's going to get worse. This is from our 2016 report, Underwater, where we looked at the region, the entire region, with 1, 3, and 6 feet of sea level rise, and we're going to see that our coastline is changing dramatically, and there will be portions of our region that are permanently underwater, including residents and jobs, unless we do more to act on that. So what's the culprit in all of this? Well, it's greenhouse gases. Greenhouse gases are what are causing this warming. Carbon dioxide makes up the largest component of greenhouse gas, so it's not the most, there are ones that are worse, but it is the most prevalent. And what are we doing about greenhouse gases here in our region? Well, we regulate carbon dioxide emissions in our region through something called RGGI that I imagine many of you are familiar with. We'll hear more about it on this panel. RGGI, put into place back in 2009, was the nation's first market-based program for CO2 in the country. It was an innovative model at the time and has led to a number of other markets around the country. And those have built on the experiences of RGGI. And I think, you know, one of the questions we are asking here today is, what is the role of RGGI going forward? Now, the way that we regulate greenhouse gases, unfortunately, leaves major sources and types of emissions unchecked. This is a graph that shows all of the CO2 that comes from, is contributed by each of our states in the region. And where you see the little check marks is basically what RGGI regulates, which is the power sector. That leaves a lot of other sources of emissions off of the regulation table. And I think, you know, if you look at the largest component in all of these, it's the carbon emissions from vehicles, which comprise nearly half of the region's total emissions. Yet, it's not part of what's being regulated in our markets. So, what did we recommend in our fourth plan? We recommended a number of things, and some of these ideas we can put on the table here today and discuss them. We thought reducing greenhouse gas emissions with more of a cap-and-invest market modeled on California's program would be an interesting way to explore. California regulates many more greenhouse gases and also all the different sectors involved with that, so including transportation fuels, industrial emitters, and heating fuels. We also thought there's the opportunity to eventually, instead of having these regional markets in different places, wouldn't it be better ultimately to have one large market, cap and invest market? We could join with California and other jurisdictions to form that more powerful market. And finally, as we generate revenue from these markets, the idea of cap and invest is that we put that money back into the things that continue to make us more carbon neutral. So a quick estimate we did based on work that TCI, the Transportation and Climate Initiative, had done and where they evaluated the amount of revenues that could be gained by regulating transportation emissions, we did a quick back of the envelope that said, well, our region, if we just focused on our region, could generate as much as $3 billion of revenue annually from an expanded market. What could we do with that money to make us more low carbon and fair in the future? So as we move ahead and work to implement this this concept throughout the region, this fourth plant idea, we have a few questions that we hope the panel might address and that we've encountered along our path. And one is REGI the right framework to build off of? Can we use this model that is different than other models to build off and make it more of an inclusive market? What are the challenges and opportunities in linking with California or other markets? You know, we're very different states, very different. This is a region versus a state. You know, what are those challenges and opportunities? A really important issue is how can we ensure that market approaches address environmental justice concerns? There's concerns that, you know, if we just let some people pollute and others not, it's going to stay disproportionately focused pollution in our environmental justice communities. What are some non-market approaches that still reduce greenhouse gas emissions? Absent a mandate, what can we do today? And then how quickly should we be acting? There was an article in the Times some weeks back saying, you know, we're denying the fact that we're in this and we're not doing enough and we're making believe we can hit the 2 degrees Paris Accord temperature. Is there more we should be doing and how quickly should we be acting? So without any further ado, I'm going to hand this over to Rit Agarwal, who's the head of Urban Systems for Sidewalk Labs. And Rit is a master facilitator and will take us through this panel. So thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Rob. And I guess I thought it would make sense for us to start off this discussion, and it will be a discussion rather than a series of presentations, by asking Dale. So Dale, along with Jean, were intimately involved in the creation of REGI. And as we think about Rob's first question around whether REGI is the right platform to build off of or the right concept to achieve this vision in the fourth plan of integrating the region into a much broader market, both in terms of its geographic scale and in terms of what it covers, I would love to get your initial kind of retrospective on where has REGI been everything you hoped and dreamed it would be? Where perhaps is its room for growth, as we say in HR conversations? what does that mean for this conversation about how we should think about the next stage for this region in this topic?
Mm-hmm. Great, thanks. Thanks so much, Rit. And it's great to see women dominating the carbon markets discussion. I think one of the best features of REGI is really the foundational design of it. It has a virtuous cycle to the design. So there's a cap on pollution. The states sell pollution permits. All the regulated sources, the power plants, buy those permits. And the states have that revenue source that they can invest on the solution side of the equation. So the power plants, in that case, are the problem side of the equation. So where is that money going? It's largely going to energy efficiency and renewables. So that's both expediting our transition to the clean energy economy. That's the purpose. That's where we're going. And it's also reducing the cost, because the more that we have efficiency and renewables, the less there's demand for fossil fuels, and then the price goes down. So it has the design itself keeps the cost down. So, I mean, ask your friends. You know, I'm glad everyone here knows what REGI is, but nobody knows what REGI is, because guess what? It's not a job-killing energy tax. It's a jobs plan, because where is that money going? It's going to efficiency and renewables in the region. So if you look at the analysis of REGI, pollution down, energy costs down, jobs up, quality of life up, you know, what's not to like? Just the word carbon, you know, if you make everything politicized. But if you don't make everything politicized, it's like a cool kids club that everybody wants to join, because who doesn't want that stuff? And I think a lot of the states have been great about talking about Reggie with their peers, you know, in this kind of language of how it's helping them solve the problems that they're challenged with in a smart way, using markets, using a market tool. But the market tool isn't the only thing, because Reggie's just an umbrella. It's just a cap. And a price is a tool, a valuable tool, but it's just one tool. I always say energy efficiency is always already the cheapest thing. We don't invest in it. Not because the cost of power is too low, only because of market barriers. So we don't increase costs to solve something that's not a cost problem. Similarly, on the transportation side, you know, I pull up at the gas station, guess what I can buy? Gas. You know, except I live around the corner from the Tesla station, which has electric charging, but I don't have a Tesla yet, but we're going to talk about that later.
I hear we know people.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that, you know, there's a framework there that's really solid. It doesn't do everything, but it's a really foundational piece of the puzzle that we could certainly apply in other contexts.
So that's an interesting argument to a certain extent, because oftentimes the criticism when you look at Reggie compared to California or other regions, and I'm saying this to Dale, but I think Kate and Jean and Kate, given your background in the governor's office, would be relevant to this. There's often the criticism, which is, you know, you look at a California auction and you're talking about a price that's something on the order of $14 or $15 a ton right now, and you look at a Reggie auction and you're looking at a price that's roughly $2. Now, with the governor's announcement last year of the increased cap, I don't actually have a good sense, maybe you all do, of what that will mean for the price of Reggie. But it's counterintuitive to hear you say, no, this is great that the price of carbon is so low under this regime. Can you say more about that?
Yeah.
Is California getting it wrong?
Yeah. Well, no, I think that we don't want high energy prices. That's not the goal. The goal is low pollution and all the energy services we need and ensuring affordability for everyone. And we should talk more about the EJPs, because that wasn't a big part of the Reggie conversation initially and needs to be. But if you're designing things in a smart way, you want to make the least cost solutions. You know, you want to drive investment in those first. And price alone doesn't do that. When my energy bill goes up, I don't throw my refrigerator in the garbage. So how am I going to get the highest efficiency air conditioning and heating system in my house? Not by higher energy bills, by programs, by having, you know, in my case, Con Ed come to me and say, you know, hey, I don't want to just sell you as many kilowatt hours as I can, and you don't even know what kilowatt hours are. I want you to have the most comfortable living situation at the lowest cost, and I want you to participate in this, you know, whatever, a home retrofit program or whatever it might be. So there are lots of ways of getting at the carbon reduction other than price. And if we only look at price, we're going to have higher costs than we need. I'm not saying that a $4 price or, you know, wherever Reggie price is going is going to get us where we are not on track. So even with Reggie, with all of its wonderful features, even expanding it to other sectors, is not going to get us on track. Mm-hmm. And price is a piece of it, but only raising the price isn't going to get us there. And if we go there gradually with all of the other non-price pieces of the puzzle that we need to deploy, then we're not going to also have sticker shock. Because when the price of carbon goes up, if I'm using a lot less energy, or I'm not even using gasoline anymore, then that price impact isn't going to affect me. I'm not going to freak out because it's my energy bill, I've already reduced it by 30%, or my transportation fuel bill, I've already reduced.
Mm-hmm. Now, does that resonate with all of you in the sense that Dale is, I mean, if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying we shouldn't be thinking as much about the price as a good thing. And frankly, at least my experience thinking about the California conversation is that they don't accept that. Is that a fair characterization? Is this a question of how a whole system is designed, or is it is it a mistake to focus too much on price, as Dale's arguing?
I can say that. I think it's pretty, is this working? I think it's pretty consistent. The analysis show that the price is not the thing that drives the change in California or in REGI. That, mm-hmm. as Dale said, it's the umbrella that has a price signal. That price signal makes some difference, but it's not the difference. Mm-hmm. If you don't do what REGI and California both do, which is to take the funds, as Dale described, and reinvest them in the system towards technology improvements, to incentives, to helping people make the changes that allow them to adapt to the price, you don't get the same kind of emissions reduction you get from the suite of policies that the funds from the policy allow you to provide.
Mm-hmm. I think what I would add, too, is you need to put any kind of public policy in context, right? And in this case, you can look at to see how, which is often the case, that states are the leaders of innovation. And you need to put REGI in the context of when it was first deployed, right? Which is the concept of creating a cap and invest program in which the dollars didn't go back to the generators, but the dollars went to consumer benefit. Radical. It's radical. So it's important for us to, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
We started at 2% of auction proceeds would go to consumer benefit, and we got to 100% by the time it was over.
So if you put it in context, right, which is important, you need to have the long view. You can see that for all of the states that participate in REGI and that participate in the Transportation and Climate Initiative, they don't view those policy initiatives as the be-all, end-all. They view them as the foundation to move towards economy-wide efforts to be able to really achieve a carbon-free future. Rutgers did a report that we released this past September with our friends at the Georgetown Climate Center and the World Resources Institute. And what we did is, we, understanding that we had a new governor coming in, we looked to see what are the policy options for New Jersey overall. So it's not just a let's rejoin REGI and check the box, right? So we looked at all the policy options and existing authorities in the state. And what are some of the innovations in other states that cross all sectors? So the question in terms of whether REGI is a great foundation, of course it's a great foundation. Just the concept alone of having 9 or 10 states with energy and environment agencies talking to each other, that's radical too, right? Mm-hmm. So it is a terrific foundation. But the other thing you have to kind of put it in context in is when REGI was first deployed, the vision was that the states would lead the innovation to really force national policy, you know, to really be able to move at the federal level, to have consistent policy across the country. And the language in the original REGI MOU even speaks to mechanisms for how the REGI states would begin to maybe step back when there's a progressive national policy that benefits the region. And the New Jersey law has very specific language as to how the state would start to step back when there's progressive national policy. Clearly, that's not going to happen in the short term, maybe even before I retire. And so the concept of innovation and thinking about the long term allows us to then see, is REGI the be-all, end-all? Absolutely not. No one thinks it is. No one thinks it is. Not one of the states thinks it is. Is it a foundation towards moving towards those kind of economy-wide limits that have been set in all or most of the REGI states? Absolutely.
Hmm. Kate, did you?
Just jump in here, and I agree we should fall in love with the problem and not the solution, the means. But I agree also. I worked with actually Scott Wiener, who's here, on trying to restructure the electric sector recently in New York, and it's still ongoing as REV, and we were trying to create a marketplace for distributed energy resources, and trying to create a marketplace from scratch is really, really hard. And so even when you have a foundation, if it's not, of course it's not perfect, we change over time, and that's kind of what I want to address. I mean, I think using what we have already, our infrastructure in this marketplace, will help us accelerate the change and impact we need. But I also think, like we were talking about price, and fortunately we have the market idea to set the price for our changing conditions is a great one. But, you know, at the end of the day, are we getting the results we need in terms of emissions reductions? And a lot of that comes down to the cap. And You know, there's a variety of things that change very quickly in society. And so with all of our policy things, these are, they affect a lot of stakeholders, and we have to have a lot of dialogue, but we also have to be nimble. And that's one thing that I think we all struggle with, trying to make these big changes. And I'm always interested in ideas of how we can move faster.
Can I ask to build on that point? So there are these two changes that are coming in terms of REGI. One is New Jersey reengaging, and the other one is
Virginia.
And Virginia, that's correct. New Jersey and Virginia, and the new cap in New York, right? We know those. There are probably others that I'm still not thinking of. But what's your perspective on things we will see in REGI? Is it going to throw off more money? Is this going to raise the price significantly? How much more effective can it be? What are the areas where the REGI system itself will lead, say, New York State to that more aggressive goal that Governor Cuomo announced last year?
Kate, we're looking at you. Say a little bit. So
predict
so,
the future. Come on, it's easy.
So there are two states coming in, New Jersey mm-hmm. and Virginia. So it'll be a significantly larger market than it is now, which is great. New Jersey obviously was in it before and is coming back. Virginia is a pretty large state with a lot of energy production and use. So that'll expand the market, which, you know, we will see what those two states coming back in does to the price. You know, they're modeling all of that, but, you know, modeling is always a guess. Mm-hmm. So all the states in REGI went through a program review that just got completed in the last year, and so they're all tightening the cap. So that will be a change that we will see how it affects the system. And they've also, to Gene's point, innovated again. Each time they do these program reviews, they look at not just what the cap is, but how the market is working. And each time they add some policy design innovation as well. And so the innovation they're adding this time is this idea of this emissions containment reserve, which will evaluate whether the price is too low to drive innovation and technology investment and behavior change. And if it is, it holds back some allowances from the system. And so this is a new idea that came from their public engagement process, and they're trying this out. And so that's a good example, I think, of how, you know, we don't know exactly what it's going to look like, but what they're doing is building on the program that they have, checking in every few years to see how it's going, and looking for ways they think they can tweak it to improve the system operations. So it's a great thing to watch and see how these changes end up playing out.
Mm-hmm. I think some other innovations I'd add to that list is that since REGI was first deployed, this, you know, the science has changed and evolved and sharpened. And so the states have really become the big thinkers, right? They're the big, bold thinkers right now. And this morning, Tom Wright, you know, told us all to think bold. And so in that regard, the states do use these program reviews to think bold. How do we really look at 25 years from now, not just 2 years from now? And so some of the issues that all the states are tackling or looking to see how they can tackle, whether that's individually or as a group, are issues associated with how do we achieve equity goals as part of our climate policy, not just REGI. Right? Another area, how many people know that 10% of the proceeds in New Jersey, the auction proceeds, go to forest stewardship and restoration of tidal marshes, right? So if New Jersey comes in at, say, you know, we'll say the auction brings in $70 million, that's $7 million a year to invest in those kind of natural systems because they absorb and sequester carbon, right? So our legislature was very visionary in that. But how do you do that? And what systems and what science, what does the science tell us about how we can create those, restore those natural systems to really be able to most effectively sequester carbon? So these are areas where the states are thinking, highly innovative.
Two of the ideas, there are two broad themes in what the fourth plan said about carbon markets in the Northeast or in the region, and Rob's questions led to them as well, and I want to take them in order. One is the idea of linking to California, right? We've got the Northeast, but of course I think at least the perception is clearly that price and CARB, their oversight agency, are driving innovation more quickly than is true in the Northeast. That may or may not be an inaccurate perception. Would love your thoughts on that. But the idea of linking REGI into the California trading system is present. Would love to get your thoughts on how that would work. Is it even a good idea? What would be required of REGI to do that? And then we'll come back to this other question, which is related, which is how do you expand it into the transportation sector? But thoughts on the California connection?
So I'll jump in. I mean, I think there's the, if you think about carbon markets, you want to, or any market, like you want to have the largest market, you'll get the lowest cost solutions for the, you know, for the least money for the most people. So expanding geographically has been on the table from, I mean, Reggie started, it sort of grew out of conversations with the New England governors and the Eastern Canadian premiers. It was like, hey, you know, we should make a big market. But as we've been saying, the market's only one piece. And, you know, we haven't even discussed politics. I mean, there's a lot of issues other than having the largest, most efficient market that matter for effective, to have effective programs. So having programs that really work well and the kinds of things that, that Kate and Jean were just talking about in terms of, you know, always refining, you know, you're sort of designing something that has a resilience in the design because there is a lot of uncertainty. I mean, when we started Reggie, gas prices were probably four times what they are now because it was before fracking. And so the design was built for a different energy world than we arrived at. The politics were different too. You know, California went economy-wide first, and that's part of the reason why Washington and Oregon can never join. Because if it had just been electric sector, they could have done it administratively. Now they need legislation. Politically, they can't get legislation. Now we don't have a regional system in the West. So it can also slow you down. So figuring out, you know, I think of it, yes, you have these top-line goals, but like bottom up, you want to build a functioning system that builds on success. And maybe it's incremental, and you're not capturing that efficiency of a larger market. But, you know, you'll get that, you'll get to that place over time, I think, because everybody does want to go there. But if you rush it, it can have unintended consequences, and it could throw a wrench in the works. And I think it's better to move with care. And just politically, that's what's going to happen. So, you know, let's not get people's expectations and draw attention away from the good work that's happening, because we're not reaching some ideal market framework.
Yeah, I want to echo Dale's comment. So, and I love the adage that sometimes the slower I go, the faster I get there. Again, please put it in perspective. And I don't mean to come across as a state government apologist, although I was in it for 22 years, but I'm not anymore. So if you put it in context, you know, the Reggie states came together, radical. And sought to create a regional market, but with the assumption that it would drive national policy. Okay, clearly that's not happening. And I don't want anyone in this room to think that that the Reggie states haven't thought, hey, maybe we should talk to other states around the country, including California, to see how we could possibly link up. Those conversations have been going on since day one of Reggie. But like Dale said, is we also want to be able to get something done. And sometimes the best way to create a sound, comprehensive policy is to take those immediate steps and show progress and show success and transform minds and transform markets. So I think we just have to, do we all want a national policy? Of course we do. And at this point, you know, the strategy for the states is to continue to build strong markets, expand to other sectors in the economy, look for opportunities to link, and at the same time, you know, look for opportunities for when we can transform federal policy.
So let me then transition to this question of the other expansion, right? Because one of the other changes, of course, is certainly by the early years of Reggie, we had gas prices and oil prices significantly higher, gasoline prices and oil prices significantly higher than they are now. We've seen a resilience in the amount that Americans are driving, so in part due to the overall economy and in part due to those gasoline prices. It would seem a logical step for Reggie or whatever the system is in the Northeast to expand to include economy-wide, and I know Kate at Georgetown, you're leading a piece of work on transportation with multiple states. What are the prospects for that? What should we know about what's easy about it, what's difficult about it, what good would it do, where maybe it doesn't do that much good?
Sure,
what's your
thanks.
Take?
So the initiative that you're describing and that Rob also referenced is called the Transportation and Climate Initiative, which is in some ways already building on the foundation of REGI in terms of the structure of the organizational model, which is that after the states and REGI launched REGI, they thought, wow, that we feel like that worked really well as a collaboration among states and among agencies within states, which to Gene's point was kind of radical. Mm-hmm. And so they said, well, boy, now we need to deal with the transportation system. Mm-hmm. Let's do something like that again. We don't know what the policy is going to be, but let's get together our energy agencies, our environment agencies, and our transportation agencies now with all these states in the region, and let's work together to figure this out, because that worked well last time, regardless of the policy. And so starting in 2010, they asked us to convene, it's all the REGI states plus Pennsylvania and the District of Columbia, to figure out how they can work together to reduce emissions from transportation. And there have been lots of projects within that big umbrella, including electric vehicles and sustainable communities, which Gene helped with, and a bunch of other stuff. But for the last few years, we've been working to look at a regional policy. And we've got lots of ideas from people about what that regional policy should be. We are having a series of listening sessions this year, collaborating with a few of the folks here to do some of those as well throughout the region to get ideas. But one of the ideas on the table is the one that that's sort of being hinted at here, which is a cap and invest type system like REGI for transportation. That's been proposed by several participants in the process, and we at Georgetown have done some analysis of that option. The report Rob mentioned is one of those analyses, which looks at the sort of the REGI-inspired model of a policy that raises funds that can then be reinvested in the transportation system. And this is really important for transportation because, as we've heard this morning and over again, the transportation system is not well-funded, and revenues are declining already. And so if we are reducing gasoline use, which is necessary to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from transportation, we are reducing gasoline taxes, we are reducing the funds that we have to fund transportation investments. How can we look at policies that also raise funds that can be invested in transportation infrastructure, and ideally in transitioning to a cleaner, more resilient transportation infrastructure? So that report imagines $3 billion per year that can be spent on investments in transportation infrastructure, but it doesn't pick a policy. A report we just released this past fall looks at whether a cap and invest type system for this region on transportation fuels could work. This is a little different than linking to California or linking to REGI or expanding REGI or expanding California. It's sort of standalone, but it's also linkable, right? It doesn't answer that question. It doesn't decide that question. This is a thing that could stand on its own. It could link to California. It could link to REGI. You could do a lot of things with it. But the question is, in the Northeast, can we do this, right? We don't have the refineries that California has. We have a couple, we have some, but we're not a fuel producing region the way California is. Does this work here? Does this make sense here? We got lots of state borders. How do you deal with that? And so this report basically looks at what kind of fuels could you cover in a system like this? Could that work? Would that work? Stuff moves between states all the time. Where would you even apply this kind of program? So we're just trying to generate these sorts of program ideas that could then do all of the things we're talking about. They could link to REGI if states choose to do that. They could link to California. They could add other sectors. But it's not starting from the point of let's expand REGI or the point of let's link to California. It's starting from the point of what works for this region, and then how do we fit that into the most efficient, most effective system for the states. And to the pros and cons question, one pro is that you don't have to get everybody to agree, right? You might have a handful of states that want to do something now, and then a handful of them who don't. REGI is a well-oiled machine in lots of ways, but in a lot of states who are used to working together on the REGI question, you'd have to get all of them to agree to take all the same steps on transportation or industry or whatever else. And if you sort of take it away from that framework, you can start and say, who wants to try this innovation? And you have a lot more freedom that way to figure out what that system is and how to design it and who wants to do it. So that's sort of where our process is starting from.
Thoughts and observations from others on transportation? Okay, now we'll come to one of the other topics I know is really relevant to Tesla. But on this question of expanding, I mean, obviously at Tesla you've got a unique perspective on the expansion of taxation to transportation fuels, maybe not unique, but what are your observations as somebody who was in government and policy and is now in the private sector, like me, thinking about how that would affect your market, your opportunities, so on and so forth. How's REGI relevant to Tesla today?
If we were to expand it to transportation?
And both, because you do both kinds of work, right? Energy and mobility.
I think that it's very important in terms of how REGI and also the California program, all these are bringing funds to help us advance clean energy, and they are going to accelerate zero-emission transportation. They, especially when you are a startup business in this space, it is giving us the oxygen to grow and to take on a lot of the incumbent battles we have to face. But I do think these kind of, whether it's however you give the price signal, whether it's a tax, whether it's a cap and invest, it's very important. And I do think we can keep improving on how we use the funds as government and society, how we use the funds to really be more inclusive and make sure that those dollars are going to the biggest impact and to raise everybody up. And that's a very complicated issue because everybody wants the money.
Well, and I think just the one thing I would keep in mind just for folks who are sort of newish, I guess, to climate policy. So all or most of the states in the REGI region have some kind of framing authority, some law that sets statewide limits. This is where we want to go in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And so I can, speak to New Jersey. And so REGI sort of has the connection to be what the state's vision is for overall reductions. In our state, in terms of some of the work we did recently, we recognized that those statewide limits, which were set 10 years ago, are still consistent with the most recent science and the Paris Accord. But to get to the 2050 limit that's set in the New Jersey Global Warming Response Act means we need to reduce statewide emissions by 75% from 2012 in the overall economy, 75%. So we have no choice but to start to look at other sectors. And we also have no choice but to look at other highly warming gases and not just CO2. And I'm sure we'll get to that as well. And I think that's what all the other states are seeing too, is that there's a framing for this, right, which is that we're not just focused on CO2 and we're not just focused on the power sector. We have a bigger challenge that we're trying to get to, and in most or all cases, that's articulated in state legislation.
Yeah, I can speak to that a little bit. So all the states in REGI, and in fact all the TCI states, Transportation Climate Initiative states, have greenhouse gas economy-wide greenhouse gas reduction goals. Some of them are in legislation, some are in executive order, some are in state plans or goals. So they are varying levels of binding, but they have all set these aspirational targets, and they all, or at least almost all, point to really ambitious reductions. They are all sort of aiming at something like 80% reductions by 2050. And you don't get there with existing policies, and you don't get there with REGI alone. You make some progress in transportation through federal fuel economy standards, which of course we are now revisiting. So the states have realized that in order to reach their economy-wide goals, they really do need to deal with these other sectors. And the analysis, again, the 2015 analysis Rob mentioned that we did, shows that if you do a policy like these pricing policies, again, not to choose one, but if you raise $3 billion in this region and you spend it on these transportation strategies, right? So you don't just raise the money and the price signal does it all by itself, but you invest in electric vehicle infrastructure, you invest in purchase incentives, you invest in bike and pedestrian infrastructure, you invest in system operations efficiency improvements, you invest in all those things and you give money to consumers and the whole suite of stuff, you actually do bend that curve down and you can get to a pathway that actually does steer you towards the 80% by 2050 goals that all of the states, or almost all of the states, if I'm wrong by a couple, have.
And I guess I want to jump in again. I actually can't believe, sorry, I'm not close to the political and policy discussion actually in these transportation and, creating TCI, but I can't believe we're debating whether or not we need to start regulating the transportation emissions in an aggressive way. I mean, these emissions are 40% of the areas, I guess. I know in New York it's almost 50% of our greenhouse gas emissions. It's growing. I feel so intensely about this that if we have every governor in New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut saying, we're going to stand up against Trump, we're going to do something about this. Like, this is it. This is the time for action. And we're seeing waves of support, but there shouldn't be a debate. And there are ways to do it that are inclusive and lift all of us up. But we have to hold the forces against it. We have to hold their feet to the fire. And a lot of people don't want to do that.
I guess, you know, Kate, though, what you've just said, I can't help but struggle a little bit with the idea that the evolutionary process is the right one right now, because it does seem that the order of magnitude of the challenge, and $7 billion a year sounds great. It is a drop in the bucket. I mean, we just had Andy Byford mm-hmm. basically tell us all to get our wallets out. And, you know, and the RPI, I mean, I think one of the things the fourth plan did, and I'm quite proud of having done, is 5 years ago we started talking about the fact that the system was about to collapse, and unfortunately mm-hmm. we were right. And we started talking about the fact that the institutions were broken, and unfortunately we were right. And now, hopefully, Byford and others will actually address this, but there is going to be a price tag that for New York City alone is going to be in the tens of billions of dollars, even if it mm-hmm. if it limits itself to that order of magnitude. And it's impossible not to look at, say, $7 billion a year and say, that's not going to do what we need to do. And so what are our alternatives? Obviously, RPA has talked about the need for more creative approaches to value capture when you make transportation investments. And of course, there are ways you can do general taxation. But it would seem to me illogical not to think about placing the bulk of the taxation burden on the things we want to discourage, as opposed to things like mm-hmm. economic development, real estate growth in our central cities and in transit-oriented locations, which, as much as value capture is great, that is something we must encourage, whereas the fossil fuel consumption is something we must discourage. Why aren't we thinking about just doing all of this times 10 and taking the risk? I mean, I think Governor Brown has demonstrated that bold leadership pays off, and if you leave Washington State behind but California moves ahead, mm-hmm. California is going to drive the country and, in fact, the world forward on a lot of this. Why can't we do that here?
Well, we can, and let's remember, we were first. California thinks they were first, but right. We actually did the market first here.
And a little competition over time will move us all faster.
I don't think you're hearing really an argument for right. incrementalism right. and like right. moderation. We're all in. You know, but how do you, you know, we still need to make it both politically sustainable and feasible for even the governors with the best intentions to do this, and you want to do it in a smart way that actually is. That people embrace because they're getting more transportation choices. If they're paying for something, they're getting something. They're not just paying another thing, and where's the solutions part? And people who can't afford to pay are not paying. And you know, the work that we still have to do even 10 years into Reggie and California, just on something like energy efficiency for low income and multifamily housing, is enormous. The time frame to deliver that and make sure that people who can't afford it are not being hurt, that energy is not being made less affordable to them, and transportation. So, you know, we do have time to do it right, which isn't that we should go slowly or not be bold, but again, just, you know, taking a program and saying, let's do 10 times the price on carbon, to me, it's the cap. We made an innovation of Reggie that wasn't in the acid rain program, people might remember. There was like phase one and phase two, and then like nothing. Like, there was no certainty for industry, then you had to like build the political will up again, as opposed to creating a system that's kind of self-correcting and self-improving without a big to-do and all the political sort of the chargedness around that. So doing that again for the transportation sector, where the solutions are front and center, where you're investing and you can see those benefits coming into communities, where you're thinking ahead, which we didn't do in Reggie, about how do you take, whether it's some of the allowance revenue or complementary policies, to make sure we are cleaning up the overburdened communities first and deeper than, you know, and that's like a front tied on the timeline, benefit that, that people are going to deliver, then, you know, as I was saying before, you can scale up, you can ratchet down the cap or scale up the price, whichever way you want to look at it. They can be interchangeable, but I think it's better to focus on the cap because that, again, we want lower pollution. We don't want higher prices, and price is a tool. So if you're going to protect people from the impact of higher prices, or you're going to ask them to pay, you have to have that whole package lined up. And I think that's, you know, that's what we're talking about, not that the price shouldn't become higher and that we're not going to get where we need to go on the time frame we need to get there if we don't have that, that higher price. But it's not a silver bullet. It's a more complicated package of things that we need to build.
I think you got to put it in perspective. When I worked in state government, if someone wanted to throw the ultimate insult at me, they'd call me a bureaucrat. And now that I'm in an academic setting, they call me an academic. So, but it gives me the opportunity to sort of look a little bit broader. And I'm giving a lecture next week to a bunch of graduate students about their question is, how's policy made? And it's like, oh, I don't even know where to begin. But so in this case, again, keep in mind when Reggie was deployed, the states assumed this is a great idea. This is going to transform the market. This is going to invest money in the clean energy economy. And of course, we're going to see federal movement. So we have consistent policy across the country that addresses all greenhouse gas emissions and all sectors of the economy. Clearly, that hasn't happened. And so now we're putting this burden on the poor, lowly TCI and Reggie states to, you know, to carry this mission forward. But what that means is that's 9 or 10 states with 9 or 10 different authorities, 9 or 10 different suites and portfolios of stakeholders, 9 or 10 states that in any given policy might have winners or losers, and the winners and losers might be different in different states. 9 or 10 states who are saying, okay, if we're going to go into the transportation sector, what's the point of regulation? Is it the vehicle or is it the fuel distributors? I mean, this is hard work. And so, you know, we love Jerry Brown, right? But that's one state. So we got to kind of put it in perspective, and again, I'll go back to the adage of sometimes the slower I go, the faster I get there, and I think in this case, with the TCI listening sessions, that's a huge step forward. That's a signal from the state saying 8 of us are really thinking big about how to move forward in terms of the transportation sector, and we want to hear from all of you before we dictate a policy.
Yeah, I'll say a couple things on that. First, just your question about the scale of the transportation needs. Absolutely. I don't think we can ever expect climate policy to bear the weight of fixing transportation infrastructure funding. It's not going to solve that problem for us. But what it can do is help. And it can help identify the funds for, in particular, the investments that help reduce emissions to, as Dale described in the beginning about Reggie, to reinforce the system and to make it cheaper to achieve those emissions reductions that we want to see to make that trajectory. So it's not going to have the numbers that we need for transportation infrastructure, but it can help. So that's my first point there. The second is that, to Jean's point, the politics are hard, right? And you know, the idea of sort of just let's raise the price 10 times. Like, I don't know any governor or legislature who's going to come out and say, so what we're going to do is raise the price of gas 10 times. Like that's just not a place that you'd ever start, right? And that's not what, and to Dale's point, that's not their goal, right? Their goal is not higher prices. Their goal is to reduce emissions. And so the Jean's point about the process is exactly right in what we're trying to do. You know, I think electricity is often invisible to people, right? You have a hole in the wall and you stick the plug in and it magically lights up and done. But transportation is not invisible to people, right? Every day people make choices about how they get to work and school and the grocery store and all around, and they are very aware of gas prices, and they're very aware of road congestion, and they're very aware of whether the bus is on time or accessible or where it was supposed to be and how, whether there's a sidewalk to it. Like, these are all things people live every day and care a lot about. And I don't think it would be wise to say, all right, here's the policy on transportation, take it or leave it. You know, the reason the states are opening this listening session process is to hear what transportation needs people have, what they're worried about, what their challenges are, so that they can provide the benefits people are looking for in building that cleaner and resilient transportation system. So it's not about a price, it's about improving the system and how do we get there, given all of the other challenges of funding and everything else.
So building on that, I think, going now to some of the solutions and what you would need to see. I mean, obviously there's investment in infrastructure, but but Kate, at Tesla, you are in the business of helping both individual homes and industrial scale facilities convert to solar and battery power, and most famously, of course, to selling electric vehicles. What are the kinds of things, whether it's related to Reggie or not, that you think would accelerate the adoption of Tesla technology, but also its equivalents in both transportation and power generation?
I think there are things that we can do in our existing regulatory framework that will enable new technology and innovation to move at the speed that we need it to. I feel a very strong sense of urgency that we planning, long-term planning is very important, but we need to actually listen to people about what are the barriers on the ground right now for technology that will make a difference, that can be deployed now, that people are willing to pay for. And having done this both in energy with project development, and I can point to New York, and also in vehicles, there are just bureaucratic barriers and throughout the system. And there's one in particular right now that we're dealing with at Tesla in the Northeast, specifically in Connecticut, New York, and New Jersey, where we're not allowed to freely sell our cars. The law was changed in New York in 2014 that made it so that we had to start franchising our business, which that's not something that we're going to do. And the same thing was done in New Jersey and in Connecticut. We've never been allowed to sell. And you know, these are some simple things. If you really want to see these transformations happen, I do think we need to look and allow innovation to come into our market. I mean, what I've seen is incumbents in the status quo, they want to keep making money the way they've always made money. And I don't blame them. But let others come in and try to solve our problems. And either we're going to get it right and understand that here, or like Asia, China, they are embracing this technology, and I am thrilled about it because that's going to help all of us. And I mean, you know, a colleague here in the area from BYD, I mean, they're doing the electric buses, and actually China just said as part of the auto trade deal that they were going to let electric vehicle manufacturers like come in and own 100% of that business there. I mean, they are prioritizing this technology. So I think the long-term planning is absolutely essential. We need these you know, kind of price signals and show what's important, but we also need to say, what can we do now? There is a lot that we can do now.
So I'm going to ask you to elaborate on what an aggressive electric vehicle adoption policy would look like. In your mind, I'm going to give you a moment to think about it, though, because we're going to turn to questions from the audience momentarily, and if you'd like to submit a question, as was announced earlier, it's the same system, Slido. They're being collected in the back, and we'll be able to read them off. So please throw up your questions. We'll turn to that in a minute. But Kate, if you know Governor Murphy had stuck around and said, what should I do to radically increase EV adoption in New Jersey, or Governor Cuomo calls, or maybe a certain other candidate calls, whatever. What would be the things you would ask for? Presumably something around this franchising law would be one of them. But
yeah, my number one thing would be let us do business. let the market work. And I, like, we are, you know, I'll say in New York, there's legislation right now that does allow a certain number of stores for zero emission vehicle manufacturers. I mean, quite frankly, I do believe in markets and competition, and so I would like to see it. I don't believe it needs to just be for Tesla. I think that we should compete. Everywhere else in the world, they allow manufacturers to sell their cars directly to consumers, and you have independent dealers. So I think that law should be changed. But, I mean, California, they have, you know, probably three times as many electric vehicles on the road. So I apologize. I'm not deep in, well, you know, what's the wish list exactly. I mean, I do think the states now in New York, which I know the best, is now starting bringing the utilities into the fold, and California has done that as well for electric vehicles, which I think is great. And what we're seeing, then you get the fight about, you know, who's really in control on infrastructure, and we get to give the money away to the customer. No, we get to give the money. I mean, I think California's done a great job. They have so many more EVs, even just for sale. Like when you have the ZEV mandate here, the manufacturers are allowed to fulfill their requirement by just selling these products in California. Like, so if I want an electric Fiat, I have to go to California to get one. I don't know if anyone's tried to buy an electric vehicle here outside of a Tesla, but it's a nightmare. And then to try to get it serviced. So I think there is probably a tremendous amount to learn from California there.
Hey, Kate, in the TCI work, have there been, recognizing that it's early days, are there themes that are emerging beyond kind of the normal plain vanilla, we need more charging stations or whatever? Are there specific things that you would imagine are going to get recommended or seem to ring true to you right now?
Yeah, so we don't get into that quite as much with our the sort of regional policies work that we've been talking about, but the TCI has had an electric vehicle initiative as part of a clean vehicles and fuels work group since it started 8 years ago. And they have spent a long time working together to explore all kinds of policy and legal barriers, you know, starting with early in the process, we did a lot of work on local planning and zoning guidance for local jurisdictions to figure out where do you put charging stations and what are the sort of design guidelines for them and what do you do with multi-unit dwellings and what do you do with businesses and what do you do with workplaces and so all of these, sort of, where do you put them, how do you put them there, what are the laws in the way, the permitting process, the inspection process, those sorts of local things. There are all the utility questions, right? So we've done a lot of research on things like who can provide charging stations? Who can invest in them? Some states, including California, initially said utilities can't own these. This should be a competitive market. They since rolled that back and have done a lot of work with the utilities to figure out how they will invest in these. But the questions about is this a competitive system? Is this a regulated system? Who can own them? Who pays for them? Can you charge the customers? Do you charge all the customers? Which ones? All of those utility regulatory questions are really important to resolve, as well as the who spends the money and where does it come from. How do you fund EV investment systems? How do you fund rebates? How do you fund insulation incentive programs? What else? The provision that Kate was describing for California's ZEV program, which many states have adopted, but has until recently had a provision in it that says if you sell a car in California, it counts for all the others, right? So you're not going to have much incentive to sell a car anywhere but California if your California sale counts everywhere. So that provision is expiring now, and I think you will see more sales in at least the other states that have this requirement, hopefully more than that. So it's lots of stuff, and it's thinking about the vehicles, it's thinking about the infrastructure, it's thinking about all of the legal and regulatory systems around both the power system and the transportation system. Which roads do you put them on? We have a bunch of states that are working together on sort of corridor planning. So you've got your local jurisdiction planning, you've got your big highway planning. You know, where do you put these on I-95 or do you not put them on I-95? And where are your gaps and how do you figure out where the gaps are? So all of those sorts of questions about infrastructure planning of the roadways and the electricity grid and everything else are all part of it. But I do think you see a lot of states really, really digging into these questions in multiple agencies and trying to figure out how to move the market, not always on your franchise question.
But and to that point, I mean, the charging infrastructure is key, and I think it, you know, workplace, home, and then, you know, fast charging to allow for long distance travel. And there are some, I mean, we have kind of papers on local laws that should be adopted, but charging infrastructure is important, and then you need the vehicles, obviously, to be there as well.
Mm-hmm. Can I just pipe in on this? I mean, I think the issue of the utility, well, first of all, there's a whole bunch of markets that have to work well, and a lot of, like, almost everything that you guys were talking about was not electric vehicles are too expensive, therefore we can't have them. It's like all of these other things, other than the cost of the product, which is now true for solar, too. I mean, it's not the solar panel. It's all the other crap that you have to do so that you can just go get one at the store and it's on your house and you're done. Same thing with the electric vehicle. Like, when we have that, the cost is going to not even be an issue. excuse me, but there's so many things that have to do with utility when you're talking about vehicle electrification. And you know, you touched on the issue of like where do you sort of draw the line, and now we have competition. But how do we take advantage of everything that the utility has to offer so that we get, you know, dollar gallon equivalent cost for electric fuel for your vehicle? You know, you need to know when can the utility offer that price. So the utility has to be able to tell you, you know, and like right now it's here, but later it's going to be over here, because as we scale up electric vehicles or as we scale up solar, those load curves change. And again, it's like planning for uncertainty. So the whole world of value that the utility can add to this, like you have basically a battery there plugged in to the system. You know, how are we going to use that in a much smarter way? The whole system is transforming right now. So, you know, there's a utility value add that really they're the only ones in a position to figure out how the system could work better, how you think of a vehicle electrification as a system asset, which also goes to the question of like who should pay which pieces of it. That is, you know, people are really at the beginning of figuring out, but is a huge piece of this puzzle.
And also keeping in mind that the transportation sector and the power sector are intertwined, right? So you want to be charging your EV in a place that has participates in RGGI, right? So that you're seeing declining from the power plant that's giving you the electricity to be able to generate to charge your vehicle. But you also really want to be transforming the power market to one that's based on energy efficiency and renewables, so that when you are charging your car, it's coming from a clean energy source. Because there is concern, you know, in some of the academic literature as to whether, you know, if we're charging to traditional power sources, whether we actually will end up seeing increases in CO2 emissions.
Interesting. Let's actually see whether there are questions from the audience. Apparently, few enough folks seem to be signed into Slido, so we're going to go the old-fashioned route. Yeah, we've got one right here. And the mic's coming to you.
Hi, I have a question. I don't know all the details of Fix NYC, but when they're putting a surcharge on Uber and Lyft and the taxis, did they consider what kind of vehicle it was, whether it was an EV or less polluting, then maybe that surcharge would be less to encourage the transformation to that? Because then you're going through the marketplace at both ends.
I don't know the answer. I like the idea, but I don't know the answer.
Well, I think your question, I don't know, none of us know the answer apparently, but the idea of like shared mobility and autonomous vehicles, and how does that whole new world of stuff play into what we're talking about? I mean, you can imagine the autonomous vehicle just going around like, you know, like that isn't good. So how do we make sure that, you know, autonomous vehicles have multiple people in them, or, you know, Ubers are, or Lyfts are, or Junos are electric, or, you know, and make sure that if that's going to be a bigger piece of our transportation equation, then we're using it in the smartest way, both in terms of density, if that's a word in the transportation sector, and the cleanliness of the operation of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Sure. Hi, Neil Weiss from Complete Cycling Advocate. Given that there are about 828,000 active cyclists in New York, and New Jersey has 8 of the most densely populated, you know, municipalities in the country, why isn't there more discussion about building out active transportation networks, given that cycling, you know, reduces twice the amount of emissions as low emission vehicles, you know, in terms of offsetting cars? Why is there no discussion of building out active transportation networks?
I would say that there is a robust conversation around that, and in many ways the TCI states have led that conversation. And that the discussion about how do we address emissions in the transportation sector, everyone always talks about the three legs on the stool, right? So the first leg is the actual efficiency of the vehicles and transforming to electric vehicles and other vehicles that use power more efficiently. But it's also about looking at, and that's when Kate mentioned the changes at the federal level in terms of the CAFE standards that causes one to have some concern. But it also is looking at the intensity, the carbon intensity of the fuels, and trying to move away from carbon-intense fuels. Another piece of the puzzle is definitely trying to get people to drive less and reduce demand. And so that's just a logical part of the conversation about how do we address emissions in the transportation sector, with conversations about how do we invest money from cap and invest programs in those kinds of programs. So I'm sorry it didn't necessarily come out in this conversation until your question, but rest assured that it is a very active part of the conversation among climate policy wonks.
Right. And please come to the state listening
sessions.
I mean, TCI, the state, they're coming to a theater near you soon. So just keep your eyes out, and we can make sure that this listener is plugged
in. I'll say right now that we had one April 9th in Albany already. The next one is May 21st in Hartford, Connecticut. The one after that is June 6th in Wilmington, Delaware. There will be more. We are working on one in this region, to TBD. But this is an opportunity to say what you think this stuff should be focused on. And I rattle off my list of investment choices kind of quickly, but one of them absolutely was bike pit infrastructure. One of them is development near transit. One of them is sort of investments in land use broadly. So these are all on the table, and that is why the states are seeking input. You know, what is it that you all think that your communities and your states and your region should be investing in? This is a great chance to tell them.
We had hoped to be in a position today to tell you when and where that listening session was going to be, and it's a partnership of various folks on the panel and in the room. But just like policy, logistics for event planning is hard. So we're expecting it to be in mid-July, somewhere in the city. But again, we'll make sure that we, because RPA is a partner, that information will get out to all of you.
Great. We had a couple over here. This gentleman, then this gentleman, and Michael.
Russ Fenari, PSEG. Gene's going to know where this question is going, because I always bring up the EJ question. And Dale, and we've worked on some of these things before, and I guess my question is, how do we leverage improving the quality of life for folks in the EJ community to take advantage of some of these things? You know, and we've talked about a number of things. I know there's issues with trying to do energy efficiency when the buildings have other structural issues, and we've tried to do some things with that, but the money just doesn't match what the issue is. I mean, there's a lot more money needed to fix that problem. There's talks about, you know, community solar or community energy systems. How do we leverage some of those things to try to put them all together? You know, put some kind of development together central to an EJ community that incorporates, you know, large-scale renewable energy, charging stations for electric vehicles, which they can't put in their homes because in an urban area that doesn't work too well, and, you know, some other things, and be able to leverage, you know, put all of that stuff together and get it to really make an improvement for folks. And I know we're going to be talking about this in New Jersey as we go back into REGI. It's a big topic of discussion. I haven't seen a solution yet that really meets the needs of what the EJ community is talking about. At the same time, I understand, you know, they're concerned that what they see oftentimes is when a lot of upscale redevelopment does take place, they get pushed out. And so you need to balance some of those things. And as someone who grew up in that particular neighborhood in Newark, where I focus on things, it's important to me personally, as well as to.
And so that's Russ's softball for me. Thanks. Thank you, Russ. So he's my plant. So one observation, I guess, two observations. So first is, you know, even 10 years ago, when we were having conversations about climate policy, the conversation about how do we address the needs of the people most impacted by a changing climate was kind of there, but not very prevalent. And so I would say it's an achievement that we're having this conversation. So Russ, thanks for throwing it out. I think the other thing is that my language has matured on this issue. And now I talk about climate impacts to communities that are most vulnerable and people who are most vulnerable. And so from the people perspective, that doesn't necessarily only mean people who are living in EJ communities or disproportionately burdened communities, but it also means people who are mobility challenged or who are senior citizens or who may be limited English proficient regardless of where they live. And there's a lot of research that shows why those populations are vulnerable. In New Jersey, when we actually mapped those populations, populations that are characterized as socially vulnerable or have some level of vulnerability, we found that 70% of them reside in the 100-year floodplain, right? So that's your opportunity to start to think about why we need to reduce emissions, but we also need to think about some of the policies associated with resilience. And so to answer your question, Russ, I guess my thinking on this has really evolved, informed on a lot of the conversations we've all had as part of the New Jersey Climate Adaptation Alliance, is that the challenge is to address the needs of those communities that are disproportionately affected by socioeconomic challenges as well as other environmental stressors is also complicated. But what we'll hear from leaders in those communities is that we need to look at the whole picture, right? So we can't just say, let's think about how we're going to spend the Reggie money and make sure it goes to EJ communities. The whole picture means that we have to look to see that if you live in a community like that and you need to have your roof fixed before you can put a solar panel on it, then public money should be allowed to fix your roof as well as to offset the cost of putting your solar panel on it. So it's asking those kinds of hard questions. It's also looking at the community as a whole, right? So the issue isn't so much CO2 emissions from this power plant. The issue is improving the quality of life in that community as a whole. And I really think that we can use climate policy, but we need to look at other policy in terms of looking at how to improve overall quality of life and health in a community. And that really sort of speaks to without a gentrification, is really improving what's happening in those communities through investments, through pollution prevention, and other kinds of holistic policies, not just climate policy.
I know we're coming to the end, but just quickly on this. And if there's anyone here who's from an EJ community or works in that field, please, it would be great to hear from you. A lot of people in EJ communities actually do think it's the pollution from that power plant in my neighborhood, and that's what I care about, and that's what I want to end. And people are not aware, there's very, very strong resistance, almost uniformly, from environmental justice advocates against market price-based programs, because the cheapest reductions is not the reduction in my neighborhood, and I'm getting screwed, so this is not a good system for me. And why wouldn't they feel that way? I mean, we need to do something that is tied. It doesn't have to be, I don't think it has to be, we can't use market-based systems anymore, but these are the trains that are leaving the station. These are the policies that the states are psyched to do, and they're happening. The complementary policy that's going to solve my problem is like on the long, you know, is walking while the train is going. So it's like, we need to figure out how to tie these things together, attack these problems front and center in a very robust way, deeper reductions, not the same, you know, targeted. It doesn't have, you know, maybe it doesn't have to be that power plant. If it is this, you know, bus depot or whatever it is, it's a real thing in the community that you can point to with a mandate that's just as strong as the Reggie mandate or whatever it is, and with a time frame that's faster and not, you know, some uncertain thing later. That's where, you know, the conversation is going. But it's very difficult because, you know, we do still want to have this tool that's valuable, and we want these benefits to happen to communities broadly, and there's a very strong disconnect in terms of what is the best way to go forward that we have to figure out how to bridge, especially if we're going to expand into new sectors of the economy.
And new warming gases. So the EJ community will say we need to think beyond the traditional greenhouse gases and we need to add black carbon to the list of greenhouse gases, officially, technically, legally.
I was at a session that the state of Massachusetts hosted last year. They jumped ahead of the game a little bit and did some state-specific sessions last year. And the variety of EJ concerns there was really enlightening for me. And you know, on one hand, people were saying, look, I don't want any more electric vehicles. I live near the power plant, and that's more electricity. What are you doing about that? Right. On another hand, people are saying, yeah, make the buses cleaner, but the bus doesn't come on time anyway, so I can't take it. Yeah. Another one said, yeah, I'd love to take the bus, but I have to push my kid in a stroller and there's no sidewalk. And so these responses were very much integrated in their experience of the system. And so yes to the power plants, yes to the access, yes to the reliability, yes to the sort of convenience and accessibility of the system, yes to all of those things. And so I think it is really thinking about and listening to people telling us what their needs are, which is why please come to the listening sessions. and we're trying to get people who aren't at big national conferences to come to the listening sessions and tell us, like, this is not my problem. My problem is there's no sidewalk. This is not my problem. My problem is I live next to the power plant. Those kinds of things.
We're going to have to wrap up here. I will observe it sounds awfully like the listening sessions we did for the fourth regional plan because it all fits together, which I would argue is one reason we should all be thinking perhaps about revenues from all of these sources, not necessarily having to be tied to one specific use, because at the end of the day, the interlinkages among the built form, the transportation system, the energy grid, and everything else go hand in hand. But I do want to thank this great panel. You've done a great job of illuminating us. And thank you all for attending, and invite you to head back down to lunch.
Thank you.